A recent U.S. Department of Justice memo opens the doors for marijuana legalization on tribal land, even in states like Wisconsin, where the drug is illegal. But as Maureen McCollum reports, the state's 11 tribal nations may not be growing or selling marijuana anytime soon.
As recreational and medical marijuana laws evolve across the country, tribal nations have been asking what it means for them. The DOJ issued a policy statement suggesting that U.S. attorneys will not prosecute marijuana laws on Native American land if a tribe decides to grow and sell it. But there's still some confusion about that memo, and many are seeking additional guidance from the federal government.
And the way I'm interpreting this is that we still have the authority to enforce these laws.
John Vaudreuil is the U.S. attorney for the Western District of Wisconsin. Marijuana is still federally prohibited, and he says he has the jurisdiction to prosecute drug crimes on tribal lands. But if a tribal nation is interested in legalizing the drug, Vaudreuil says he would meet with leaders.
I would sit down and start a dialogue immediately. They know it. I'll get in the car tomorrow and drive to Red Cliff all the way up to Bayfield. So we'd talk about it.
Vaudreuil says none of Wisconsin's tribal nations have approached him about this yet, but he has heard of companies approaching tribes, selling the idea of legalization as a way to make money. The issue is further complicated by the fact that marijuana is still illegal under state law. Outgoing Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen says regardless what the DOJ decides, he'd tell law enforcement to continue pursuing marijuana cases on tribal lands until the state legislature legalizes it. At the Lac du Flambeau Reservation in northern Wisconsin, officials have been intensely cracking down on drug use. Last year, they issued an unprecedented state of emergency to deal with drugs after a rise in overdoses, suicides, and crime. Since then, about 85 non-tribal members caught selling or using drugs on the reservation have been banished. A drug and alcohol treatment facility for tribal members is under construction. That being said, Lac du Flambeau spokesman Brandon Tomes says leaders are not talking about legalizing marijuana anytime soon.
What kind of message would that send to those people suffering right now that we're trying to help? And especially, what kind of message would it send to our young people? You know, the ravages of drugs and alcohol have been felt in Indian country, and I think our tribe in particular is really doing its best to solve some of those issues.
Within the Ho-Chunk Nation, leaders have not taken up the marijuana legalization issue formally. President John Greendeer says the tribe has been working hard at promoting healthy lifestyles and cutting back on high levels of addiction, obesity, and diabetes. He says legalizing marijuana doesn't fit in with those efforts right now.
I don't think there really is a lot of information that supports both the medical use or what ends up typically happening is the recreational use. And that's kind of something that we've been working steadfastly against in our communities.
Greendeer says tribes elsewhere could legalize marijuana as a way to flex their muscle at the federal government. He says other tribes could benefit economically. Greendeer says the Ho-Chunk Nation doesn't feel that's a good enough reason at this point.
I don't want to see our nation as being known for the nation that can grow pot for everybody. And I think that is a tremendous disservice to the decades of the reputable imaging that our former leaders have done to promote the wellness that our tribe has been known for.
The Menominee Nation, Mohican Nation Stockbridge Muncie Band, Oneida Nation, and Bad River Band of Lake Superior Chippewa also say they're not considering marijuana legalization at this time. Five other tribes did not respond to questions on the issue. Maureen McCollum, Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse.
We all know what food's for, right? It's nourishment, nutrition, fuel. For every other species, that's more or less the end of the story when it comes to food. But as our next guest writes, for humans, food plays a much bigger role.
We're the only species that shares food as more than just a way to stay alive. Food is kind of a social glue. You don't see dogs sitting around a table eating a Christmas dinner together.
Playing poker,
maybe. It's part of what makes us humans, part of what makes a human a human.
At a time when you're probably gathering with family and friends to share important holiday meals over the next few weeks, we thought it'd be a good time to examine the role that food plays in our lives and what makes us human. Rebecca Roop joins us now. She writes for National Geographic. She's the author of How Carrots Won the Trojan War, A History of Garden Vegetables. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, do we have...
Always fun to talk to Wisconsin.
It is. I do it every day, and I love it. Well, are we overstating it? I mean, is food a central part, apart from the nutritional side, a central part of human life, of human society?
A lot of anthropologists say yes, that it's actually one of the things that distinguishes us as human beings from all the other animals. You know, we're the only animals that celebrate by gathering food, by sitting around together and using sharing food as a means of communication. There's one theory that says that all of the fundamental human essentials, things like our kinship systems, spoken language, technology, think of cooking, even ethics, may have come from our habit of sharing food. You know, we had to go out and get it, bring it home, prepare it, and divvy it up.
So sharing food is a key part of our evolution, maybe physically, but also socially as a species?
Absolutely.
So how long do we know that humans have been sharing meals like this in this social way?
Well, we know that the earliest hearths, which indicate that we were cooking and sharing food preparation and meals, you know, go back, you know, at least 500,000 or 600,000 years, and possibly close to 2 million years, based on some fairly recent discoveries in South Africa, which look like we might have been cooking a lot even before there were people. So our nearest ancestors may also have shared meals.
Well, let's move to the modern day now. That's kind of how we got here. What are the benefits today of sharing a meal, maybe as a family?
Well, they say that the benefits to kids particularly are phenomenal. People develop stronger family bonds, communicate better with each other. Sharing meals is a way of passing on your values and traditions, and healthy eating habits. People tend to eat better if they eat family meals, as opposed to, you know, sprawling on the couch with your bag of Cheetos and a beer. And the kids who share family meals tend to have better social skills. And as teens, they get along better with their parents, do better in school. There are lower incidences of depression, obesity, drug and alcohol abuse. Though, of course, you know, a family meal isn't a cure-all to all family problems. You know, if you're hurling plates at each other all day, just suddenly sitting down around the table and passing the macaroni and cheese isn't going to solve all problems. But it certainly has a lot of social and psychological benefits.
There's a concern that I see a lot, an idea that, okay, there was a golden age back in the day. We sat down for that family dinner 7 days a week or close to, and now we don't, or at least we do it less. Is there anything to that?
Yeah, the statistics indicate that we're all a lot busier. Our schedules are a lot more packed. It's really hard to get all of us together around a family dinner table each and every night. You know, we've moved on from Leave It to Beaver. The statistics show that Americans eat one out of every five meals in the car. One in four
Wow.
Americans eats a fast food meal every single day. And then the numbers kind of vary. One poll showed that about 30% of people sit down to dinner as a family group each and every night. And then about 50% manage to share maybe four meals a week, which, I think that's pretty good.
Well, and now we're at the holidays, and a lot of traditions surround that. Can you talk about some of the variety of holiday traditions that we might run into in this country, maybe around the world?
Oh, goodness, holiday traditions. Inevitably, one holiday tradition is a massive shared meal, you know, which is more than just an everyday family meal. It's what you would call a feast, a banquet, a dinner party. So it's not just the nuclear family group. It's your extended family, friends, acquaintances, neighbors. So this is, bigger, usually more formal than the average sit-around-the-table family meal. And these can be absolutely wonderful. You know, it's a chance to see people that you haven't in a long time. And share food, and share particularly special and delicious food, which we often make a centerpiece of big dinners and family feasts.
And one thing that I love about the traditions here in the U.S. is that the choices are often that marker of our ethnic heritage. I'm thinking of the Polish side of my family. Pierogies always show up. There's a big production to make the Christmas pierogies. Do you have a unique holiday food, Rebecca?
Well, you know, one of the unique holiday foods around here in northern Vermont, you know, we're right on the border of Quebec, is pork pie. A lot of people eat that. It's a traditional French food.
Well, count me in. I think I'll give that a try. We're talking to food writer Rebecca Roop, talking about the role sharing meals has played, well, in our development as humans and plays in our daily lives with the family dinner and our annual holiday traditions as well.
We want to hear from you as well. What foods are important to you and your family? What's on your table this holiday season? What are your holiday feast traditions? Do you have a special meal that you make every year for the holidays? And do you have any recipes that are legendary in your family? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Mike Arnold. We're continuing our conversation with food writer Rebecca Roop about the role shared meals have played in human history.
And we're taking your calls to what foods are important to your family's traditions, whether at the dinner table on any given day or maybe a special holiday tradition. Is there a food that, you know, if it wasn't there for the particular holiday, it wouldn't count, wouldn't be a real holiday? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to a caller. We've got Chris on the line in Portage. Chris, hi.
Hi, I'm in Portage, but I'm from Cambria, and we have two recipes that are musts for the holidays. The first one is a mango curry cheese ball. And it's made with cheddar cheese, and then you put onions and you put cream cheese, and then you cover it with curry, Worcestershire, Tabasco, and mango chutney.
Okay, Chris, I'm going to stop you on that one for a minute. Cheese balls, sure, in Wisconsin. Where did the mango curry part of it come from?
We were touring a plantation in Little Rock, Arkansas, and the owner and my husband hit it off. And they ended up visiting after tour hours, and he shared this recipe with my husband. And for years, he wouldn't give it out. But now everyone, it's gone viral pretty much.
Brilliant. And then you had another recipe, Chris.
I do. George Washington eggnog, and it's made with lots of eggs, heavy cream, sugar, and then lots of liquor. And we make it every year, and it's very smooth and wonderful, and it's for adults only.
I guess so. Well, is that a big production, making your own nog?
It was something that my husband actually passed away, but he did it every year, and the tradition continues. Like, all the nieces and nephews have called me for the recipe, so it'll be at every holiday home this year, so that'll be nice.
Wonderful. Well, Chris, thank you so much for the call. Rebecca, there are these, I guess, invented traditions, these found traditions that people maybe stumble across, like that mango curry cheese. Is that a common? Do a lot of families have a story like that?
I'm sure they do. And, you know, think of all the things that we used to run into as kids. You know, fruitcake.
Yeah.
Fruitcake was always like a running joke in certainly my family. So I've just learned that fruitcakes, which we always sort of thought should be used as doorstops, can be basically really delicious and yummy, and have this fascinating, huge, long history. So I clearly am a person who has never appreciated fruitcake as it deserves to be appreciated.
Well, is this something that's, you know, maybe when you buy it from the fundraiser from the church or school, maybe it's not so tasty, but if you actually go to the trouble of making your own, you can really jazz up an awesome fruitcake?
You absolutely can. Some people say that the fruitcake really fell from favor in the early 20th century when fruitcake started being made commercially. Mm. So they were sort of dry, tasteless bricks. But if you make them yourself and use dried fruit instead of that, you know, day glow orange and green candied fruit that's often found in supermarkets, and of course soak them in enough not for children brandy, rum, or whiskey, you know, they can be absolutely scrumptious.
Well, Chris, thanks a lot for the call. If you swing by the studio, bring some of that mango curry cheese dip and some of the nog to wash it down. Back to our callers now. We've got Deborah on the line with us in Brown Deer. Deborah, hi.
Hello. This is not what I originally planned on saying, but she reminded me that last caller, or the person just mentioning the guest, I mean your guest who mentioned fruitcakes. When I lived in Dallas part-time during the one winter, I worked for this lady who baked fruitcakes out of her house. And there was like eight people, like young teenagers there, and she charged $50 a fruitcake, and she put a pint of rum in each one, and Federal Express was there all day long. I don't know. I don't think she put the traditional fruit in it, but there's a little inspiration for somebody to start for a startup business. But my mom cooked a meal every single night of my life. I know, because I did the dishes. Me and my sister would trade nights. But I remember a couple sayings. The Solis up the street had a grace. It was rub-a-dub-dub, thanks for the grub, yay God. And I always thought that was funny. And then my dad would say, eat every bean and pea on your plate. And that was funny to us. And we hated our vegetables, but the most important thing is the memories. And, you know, although kids don't think it's important when it's happening, and that goes for all events, when they grow up, it becomes very, very important. So I have to say, yeah, sitting down and eating a meal with your family is awesome.
Deborah, thanks. What an interesting point, Rebecca, the idea that, okay, this is happening for the kids. They don't know it's a big deal. They don't know they're being passed on society and culture in meal form. It doesn't occur to us until we're grown-ups and look back.
No, and, you know, when you think of it, it's really an essential part of being brought up. I think table manners is a big deal. You know, if you've got reasonable table manners, if you know, you know, how to eat politely, I mean, this can have an impact on your life. You know, you're going to spend the rest of your life going out to dinner with, you know, potential loved ones, potential employers. And, you know, you don't want to eat your mashed potatoes with your fingers.
Well, sadly, one of my family's lasting traditions was my mom's frustration with the rest of us for not picking up any of those table manners, no matter how hard she tried. There were a lot of great moments in that. So still, we never quite got the table manners right, but a lot of good memories anyway. Back to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line with us in Princeton. Mike, hi there.
Hello, good evening. We used to have a great Christmas tradition that we would have my grandmother's Croatian sweetbread, which was called bogači or pagači. And it was a great giant loaf, and it took her all day to make. It was like a dozen eggs and a pound of butter and 10 cups of flour. And everybody couldn't wait to get to Grandma's pagači.
Mike, I got to ask you now, have other people picked up Grandma's recipe since then?
Of my four brothers and four sisters, I'm the only one who makes it now.
Okay, and are you going to try to pass that tradition along yourself?
Absolutely, absolutely. Everybody says whenever I come to a holiday gathering, Mike, did you bring the bagachi?
Mike, thank you so much. Thanks for sharing that story. Again, our traditions live on from generation to generation, these foods, Rebecca.
Yes, they do. I'm remembering my grandmother always made a special cookie that nobody has ever been able to reproduce because the recipe was from a cookbook that I think belonged to her grandmother, and it was a wood stove cookery. So these wonderful sugar cookies, none of us since have been able to figure out how to get them just chewy and yummy enough.
Now, a lot of us, as we approach the holidays, if we're cooking for a big crew, the positives may not loom so large in our minds as the hassle and the work that we have to do going into it. Can you give a pep talk that yeah, maybe it's worth the work to bring this feast together for everybody?
I think it's definitely worth the work. People will remember this forever, and it's a time of once you get this food to the table, it's a time of such warmth and sharing and togetherness, at least ideally, that I think it's something we should all aim for.
Now, you mentioned the pork pie. What else do you have, Rebecca, holidays or not, that you think of as, you know, maybe a trademark thing or like a thing with a story to it and a tradition to it for your friends and family?
Oh, something that we do with a tradition or just in general. One of the things my family does as a tradition is attempts to do something new every year for Christmas Eve dinner. You know, when we've done Chipino, we're doing surprise Indian food this year, which I don't know much about yet since my sons are cooking it.
Well, that's amazing, a tradition of doing something different each time.
Untraditional.
And do people buy into it? Are they getting into that? Are they open to the experimentation? Or are they saying, "Oh, what happened to the pork pie?"
You know, there's some of each, I would say.
All right. Well, Rebecca,
as long as they get chocolate covered peanut butter balls, they're happy.
Oh yeah, actually, Veronica Rickert, our regular co-host here, made some of those for the Central Time staff. I was very happy to see them because my aunt usually made them, and I was notorious for eating like a plateful of them at a time. Rebecca, thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks a million. This was great. Happy holidays.
To you too. We've been talking to Rebecca Roop. She's a National Geographic author, a food writer. Her books include How Carrots Won the Trojan War. That's a history of garden vegetables.